When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Hey, it's John here. The podcast hasn't technically started yet. It'll be along in a minute, I promise. But before we get going, I just wanted to basically ask you all for a favour. You're all very nice people. You've all been listening to us enthusiastically, I hope. So now I want something in return. I'm not going to ask for money, don't worry. What I would like, though, is if you had 5 minutes to give us a nice review on iTunes and to tell your friends, because we'd like to get more people listening to this and we think you're the best people to help us do that. So go on, be nice, do us a favour. Anyway, that's the public service announcement over. I now return you to your normal podcast service.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Hello and welcome to Skylines, the City Metro podcast. I'm Barbara.
And I'm John. And this week we're talking about how it all fits together.
People talk about Los Angeles, you know, they always refer to the movie Who Framed Roger Rabbit as sort of the original sin of Los Angeles is to have been built around the car.
The mayor has a lot of power in New York compared with London, and it's got a Department of Transport that runs all the transport in the boroughs. You know, there aren't any boroughs running transport, which you've got 32 in London.
The streetcars closed, the last red car in Los Angeles ran between Los Angeles and Long Beach in, I want to say, 1963.
So, as I've mentioned before, I think I grew up in an outer suburb of London in what we know as Zone 6, which is a particularly sexy and attractive zone on the transport map, but it basically means I grew up like, you know, 10, 12, 15 miles out of town in a place that is, administratively, it's London. You get the mayor, you've got the Metropolitan Police, you've got London Transport. But people don't like to think of it as London. Like, you ask a lot of the people in Bromford, where I grew up, where they live, they won't say London. They would probably say Essex, which is the county it used to be part of, which is, you know, has a very strong identity of its own. And this strikes me as this issue of where cities end and their hinterland begins strikes me as kind of, it's one of the things we talk about quite a lot, because human beings are obsessed with identity and definitions, basically. I mean, Barbara, you grew up in a sort of commuter town, like maybe 80 miles from London. As someone who wasn't a Londoner and now is, where does London begin?
I think about Zone 3, maybe, at a push. I mean, it's impossible to talk about this without talking about the tube map if you don't know much about London, which I didn't. So I would just go in, I'd go to the central bit. I would think that the edge of Zone 3 looked very far out, and that was kind of as far as it went.
Okay, so let's try a couple of places. Is Hammersmith in London?
Yes.
Okay, is Richmond? It's got a nice park, it's got some deer in it.
No, see, I think Richmond is quite self-contained as like another town, especially if you haven't gone there now. It kind of feels like you're getting off the train in somewhere else. Clapham Junction is a bit like that as well.
Clapham Junction's like 5 minutes away. You're like, God, you're a real sort of hardliner on this. You're like a London purist.
Yeah, I think, well, also just because if places seem to be... Because, I mean, what you were saying just now is it's not actually always that people want to be part of central London, that places that do have their own identity and their own sort of centre, you kind of want to give them credit for that in a way and not just say they're sort of an edge of another place.
Yeah, no, I think that's true, but it doesn't seem universally true. So I grew up in Romford, which has a very strong idea of an Essex identity, and so probably doesn't think of itself as London. If you cross the Thames, there's the Kentish suburbs like Bexley and Bromley that I think feel the same. Or like you go southwest. I used to work for a website called Londonist, and we would get a lot of angry comments whenever we wrote about Kingston upon Thames, because someone from Kingston upon Thames would just leave sarky comments going, "It's actually in Surrey, you know,"
which is irrelevant, really, the county thing, but people do fixate on it.
Yeah. But if you go to northwest London, if you go to places like, I don't know, Uxbridge or Harrow or Ruislip, which are just as far out, people there, I think, do identify with London. And partly I think that's probably because it used to be in a county called Middlesex, which isn't there anymore. It just has been subsumed by London. Mm-hmm. But partly also I think it's because those areas all have the tube.
Yeah. I mean, Uxbridge is the end of the line, isn't it? I remember once coming to London without knowing much about London and agreeing to go back to my friend's house for a bit before going back to Winchester, getting on the tube, getting to Uxbridge, realising it took me longer than it would have taken me to get back home in the first place, which is when I was like, oh, right, the tube does go quite a long way. Okay.
Okay, let's stop obsessing about London. Let's move on. You grew up in Winchester.
Yeah.
Is Winchester, it's a commuter town for London? Is it in any way London? Is it part of somewhere else? What is it?
I think so. People, its closest big city is Southampton, which is interesting because it's very, very different to Southampton in a lot of ways. It's very kind of wealthy, and I think its qualities, its demographic qualities, come basically from its proximity to London rather than to Southampton, because Southampton is a great city, but it has all kinds of problems. And has quite a high crime rate, quite difficult kind of other social factors. So I think there is an interesting effect whereby if you think of each of those, if Winchester and Southampton as having a gravity like a planet, and obviously Southampton's much bigger, is kind of a huge bustling city. And yet people who are closer to Southampton on the map will often say, oh, I'm from Winchester, which for not a very big town / city, it's questionable, which it is quite funny, I suppose. It's a similar effect to Romford versus London.
Jim Smith, who writes for City Metric sometime, he did a piece on how Boris Johnson was actually a Saturday Night Live actor, if you saw that one. And I can say this because I know he doesn't listen to the podcast, but he claims that the village you grew up in is part of Stratford-upon-Avon. But if you look on the map, it's basically a suburb of Redditch, which in terms of a suburb of Birmingham, and like it's miles from Stratford-upon-Avon. Yeah. But because of a combination of county boundaries and snobbishness, I think it's just cooler to be associated with Shakespeare's birthplace than Redditch. But I mean,
shockingly,
I obsess about this because I'm a slightly geeky man who likes drawing lines on maps and has somehow made a career out of it. But I think this stuff can actually have a real impact on how we govern our cities and what they're like. So if you look at what's going on in Paris at the moment, Paris is a great example of a city which historically had a very tight boundary. It's like the equivalent of zones 1 and 2 in London.
Yep.
So if you directly compare the populations of Paris and London, Paris looks tiny because you're really only counting the centre. But it is surrounded by all these other places that are, you know, functionally, they're part of Paris. They've just been managed independently. So it's trying to move away from that kind of better integrate them. Mm-hmm. And it's creating this the Metropole de Grand Paris, which is kind of like a sort of equivalent to Greater London, because not having had that structure, a lot of these places are very cut off in terms of transport. They've not, their economic development has been ignored, and you kind of end up with the banlieue.
Yeah, but equally I think you can see that if you are a relatively fragmented bit that really is just on the edge of the thing that is Paris, you wouldn't necessarily get that identity of your own, that you wouldn't kind of rally around your particular area, and so you kind of lose that sense of identity. Maybe
you're saying some of these places will end up sort of neither here nor there. They don't get to be part of Paris, but at the same time they don't have the kind of proud Winchester style independence.
Exactly. Yeah. Winchester soon to secede from Southampton.
I think you can see this stuff at work elsewhere in England as well, actually, where for those who aren't familiar with the exciting ins and outs of our devolution debate, most of the other major cities in England are kind of en route to trying to create what are called city regions. So sort of like Greater London. It was Greater Manchester's quite a long way along this path. But Manchester's easy because all the outer boroughs have kind of long accepted that their fortunes are tied up with the success of Manchester. And that's not true of all these places. So if you look at the West Midlands deal, which is the Birmingham, Wolverhampton, Coventry, I think a lot of people were surprised that that came through at all, because Wolverhampton and Coventry particularly are so sort of vehement that they're not part of a greater Birmingham. They are their own independent cities. So our mates at the Centre for Cities, who are our data partner, they produce a database looking at all British the figures on British cities, and they get endless angry emails from Wolverhampton because the system they use is counts it as part of Birmingham and Wolverhampton isn't having any of it. So it was a bit of a surprise that that deal was happening at all. And in other places, similar deals are not happening. Like, there was meant to be a sort of Leeds, Bradford, Wakefield kind of region, and that's just not happened because of endless rows about where the boundary is and whether these places are really part of Greater Leeds.
Yeah, it does really matter to people, which is almost surprising, I suppose. But we all do it. I mean, we all want some say over where people say that we're from, where we live.
I think it's much easier to get passionate about identity than it is about functional economic geographies.
Yeah,
it's just not very sexy. I mean, I find it interesting, but as we've often discussed, am pretty weird. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think this is a problem they get internationally?
Yeah, I think it's just part and parcel of living in a city that you do identify with. I mean, I'm not sure that people in very rural areas identify strongly with the name given to the big swathe of empty land where they live.
Well, yeah, I think that's the Chinese system. They are basically imposing these structures and saying, okay, this huge area is a city called, I don't know, Shanghai or whatever, but actually a lot of it is not something we would recognise as a city yet. It is just the land on which they are expecting to build commuter towns for Shanghai, effectively.
But equally, other bits of all cities in China, in fact, kind of bleed into each other without any kind of obvious boundary. I think as urban areas get bigger and bigger and kind of jump onto each other like that, it'll be interesting to see what happens.
So there's a word for that, isn't there? Megalopolis, which is definitely a word.
Well, I learned this in geography when I was about 7 or something, and I was really excited by this concept of all these cities kind of sprawling into each other and eventually having a world that was just covered in buildings. But I went home and was told by my mum very sternly that it in fact was not a word.
Yeah. And for, if Barbara's so mum is listening, I can assure you it definitely is a word. And you can tell I'm right,
because really
I'm the editor of citymetric.com. But I mean, there are other megalopolises out there. I think have you heard of the blue banana? It's one of my favourite economic geography terms.
No.
The blue banana is an EU idea that basically there is a sort of West European urban zone that kind of stretches all the way from basically Liverpool, Manchester, Leeds, up in the north of England, down through most of England, jumps across the Channel through Belgium and the Netherlands and down through Western Germany. So it comes to rest somewhere around Rome, basically. And if you look at it, it is a huge percentage of Europe's population is concentrated in that kind of arc. They call it a blue because of Europe and banana because it's a bit wibbly. But the other one is the US Northeast megalopolis or Boswash, which again is just an enormous chunk of the US population in you know, Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Washington, that all kind of bleed into each other. Mm-hmm. And you can't necessarily sort of draw a line down the middle of Trenton, New Jersey, and say this side is the commuter zone for New York and this side is the commuter zone for Philadelphia. Because, you know, people in Philadelphia commute to New York now. You know, you get, it's described as the sixth borough sometimes, probably mostly by real estate agents in Philadelphia, I suspect. But nonetheless, that is theoretically possible as something you can do.
Yeah, and you sort of wonder, will those individual identities continue or not? I mean, I suppose that it's whether you think the centre of those cities does have enough draw that it kind of...
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
They will keep themselves as these separate entities.
Mm-hmm. I think places that start with a strong identity are likely to keep it.
Mm-hmm.
It's places that don't have that start of it's more likely to fade away. But I know we're speculating a little bit. It strikes me that really what we're talking about here is sort of integration of different places integration of many things into one big thing. And that can be pretty hard to do, and not just for places but for institutions.
This is a Brooklyn-bound A express train. The next stop is Dyckman Street. This is a 125th Street-bound A express train. The next stop is 59th Street, Columbus Circle.
Hi, I'm Tim Fendley from Applied Wayfinding, and we design city information systems.
So one of the questions that presumably comes up quite a lot when designing city information systems is that of integration between different political bodies, the integration between different modes of transport. I mean, how does that kind of affect your work?
It's a really good question, because you can't really do anything unless the city is working together in some form. And you've got to understand how cities are structured. We've worked with lots of cities. We've found similar ways in which they're structured. They're called different things. They might be called boroughs. They might be called transport authorities. They might have business improvement districts. But really what you've got is, quite rightly, you've got this distributed, I'm running certain services and you're running those services, and there's places where we cross over. So I think the ways the cities are structured is really, it's naturally, it's reaching a balance, which is correct. When it comes to movement, there's a problem, because what you've got when you're moving is that actually people want it all to fit together. They're desperate to just jump off the bus and get on the tram, or jump off the tram and walk to where they want to find, or where do they park their bike, and then, you know, or use the bike hire system or whatever. And they're not interested in all these different organisations that are providing the services. They just want them to fit together. So you've got these two opposing kind of like structures.
So I think there's a tendency to speak of a city like New York as if it's, you know, a monolithic thing. As you say, you know, New York is doing this to its transport network. But really it's not one entity. It's more like a collection of cats tied together in a bag, constantly sort of fighting each other.
Wrapped around with legacy, yeah, of like how it got created. And, so, you know, it doesn't quite fit together.
So let's stick with New York. I mean, you guys have worked there. What are the kind of different bodies that are in play in terms of trying to create a functioning city transport system there, and how well do they interrelate?
Well, their transport system's totally a representative of legacy. You've got the subway system, which is run by the MTA. You've got the mayor has a lot of power in New York compared with London, and it's got a Department of Transport that runs all the transport in the boroughs. You know, there aren't any boroughs running transport, which you've got 32 in London. So you've got a very strong Department of Transport, but yet the Department of Transport only has a kind of like a relationship with the MTA. The MTA, and then you've got PATH, and then you've got other providers dotted around.
The subway,
yeah,
that is run jointly with the New Jersey authorities.
Yeah, it's basically the New Jersey commuter lines that come into Manhattan. Why that isn't all part of an MTA transport network kind of would make sense, I think. But in there lies a lot of politics, and they do okay. There's lots of handoffs between them, and they're trying to get there. But you've got to then contrast that with look what happened in. Sorry to bring it back to London, but look what happened in London when you put the underground together with the buses, and then the investment that the bus team did on integrating information as you come out of the tube station and which bus to get, and the ridership that's increased by doing that kind of thing. It's a fundamentally connected system, and we see from the people's perspective that is very much what people find useful and completely improves ridership.
So that's the prize here, is that people can kind of get on the bus, switch to a tube, switch to a train from that, and it kind of feels not seamless, but like, you know, the systems are meant to work together. I'm assuming that, you know, city authorities in New York, all, obviously they want everyone to be able to sort of commute very easily from one side of the city to the other, so they're presumably working together harmoniously to achieve that goal.
Presumably. now, the thing is that any organisation like that has a remit, and their remit is often, even if they don't want it to be, it's limited to their area and what they're doing. And that's why a bigger organisation, a bigger objective actually is needed. And you can do that by getting everybody to work together, but the best way in the end is going to be actually making them all run together. So we're working in Toronto. There's 10 different transport authorities, loads of legacy, and they kind of have a minimal functional handoff between each other. And we did a piece of research, and we sent one young lady, she's about 20, and we sent her on a journey on the Google Transit. It was going to take her 3.5 hours and use 4 different transport systems. It actually took her 11.5 hours.
Ow.
And she didn't make it. And the services weren't not working. It wasn't, the trains and the buses weren't failing. It wasn't blocked.
Sorry, when you say she didn't make it, you mean she just ran out of time. She wasn't like eaten by a bear or
something. It was dark and late, and her mother went to pick her up in the car because she just was upset, and 11.5 hours trying to get back, because we sent her somewhere and then said, then get back this way. And it should have taken her 3.5 hours, according to the journey planner. And why was it 11.5 hours? Well, we didn't tell her how to do it, so this was working with a reasonably intelligent Torontonian in her own city. But yet, transport networks she'd never travelled on, because a place that she'd never been to, were typical journey she might want to do to see a friend. And so, for example, I'll give you one little example. So she knew she had to get a bus from, she had to get off at this train station and catch a bus to do the next leg of the journey. And at that station, we didn't know it, because we didn't plan a bad journey. We just said, try that and come back. We actually did this in a number of people and found all sorts of results. And what she did is that she got off the train where she thought she should, and actually at that train station, there were 2 stations named 2 different things. The bus people called the station one thing, and the train people called the station another thing. And yet it was the same station, but she didn't realise that, so she didn't get off at there because she was looking for the bus name, because that, on her journey planner, was where she was going from. So she kept on the train line all the way to the end, thinking, well, I will get off when I get here. And she didn't, so then she went back, and then she had to find... So she wasted 2 hours doing that. Mm. So that's the confusion, an individual's experience, that's how it feels. And that, I think, is the bit... That's where we're bothered about.
I mean, we came in by talking about institutions working together. Is the need for that going to get superseded by things like, you know, apps like CityMapper is an incredibly good app that you can just kind of, you just tell it where you want to go and it will give you multiple options and sort of, it almost sort of overloads you with information that you're probably not going to need about, you know, where to stand on the platform or whatever. Can that kind of technology plug this gap without massive institutional upheaval?
Yes and no. Yes, those things, and it's not just going to be CityMapper, it's going to be all sorts of services are going to come out that are going to give you this information. But it's what it needs to happen is the digital has got to fit with the physical. It's got to be connected on the ground. For example, another station in Toronto has got three different bus services. It's got three different stations. And how do you find your way from one to another is hard work. And you arrive at one and think you can get on a bus, and you walk around looking for that bus, and it doesn't exist at that part of the station. Now, CityMapper and Google Transit and Move It have not got that level of granularity to help that connection. And maybe they could in the future, but that is going to require integration with those organisations. So these organisations have got a part to play. And they either do one of two things. They either find a kind of like a harmonised way to do things and a relationship that's going to do it, or they need to be much more of a same organisation.
Thank you, Tim.
The Euclid Avenue bound F train via the A line. The next stop is Nostrand Avenue. This is a Brooklyn bound F train via the B line. The next stop is Grand Street.
Now we're moving on to the portion of the show where someone tells us about their city. So this week we're hearing from one of our writers about his city, which has had its own problems really in terms of integrating different areas, different identities into one city unit.
Okay, so I'm Drew Reed. I have been contributing to City Metric for almost 2 years now. I'm originally from Los Angeles, and it might seem a bit ironic, but I think that actually to me is what drove me towards the idea of studying cities and urban planning, urban issues in general. Los Angeles seems sort of like the anti-city, the city of sprawl, the city, who people don't like cities move to. People talk about Los Angeles, they always refer to the movie Who Framed Roger Rabbit as sort of the original sin of Los Angeles is to have been built around the car. Where I came from, within greater LA, I'm not from LA proper. I'm from Long Beach, I think of Long Beach a little bit like the New Jersey of Los Angeles. It's outside of the sort of area in which, the movers and the shakers in the film industry and, other important industries do things closer to the center, as it were, of the city. It's one of the few areas in LA that is a little bit more dense. It's older. You can still sort of see, the traces of the streetcar era, and that there was this very brief, but I think still somewhat important time. Most of the area was farmland at the time, but there were these very small pockets that did, operate like conventional cities. And one of them was Long Beach. There was a brief time when the area that we call downtown LA, which now has kind of been disfigured almost, but it did work as, a functional, I'd say small to maybe mid-sized city within the context of America at the time. And then what happened was there was a boom in growth in Los Angeles, and that was from streetcars. And I believe there's a bill in the 1920s for the city to take over at the time the private streetcar and, interurban, sort of more long distance rail lines. And that didn't pass. In addition, the streetcar companies were sort of saddled with this extra burden that they had to, in addition to paying all their operating costs and things like that, they had to pay for the upkeep of every road that a streetcar line went down. So really pretty early on, you had this kind of original orientation toward, walkability, I guess, streetcars, mass transit, but that quickly shifted towards the car as this, new modern way of life that was going to, rid us of our ills in this area. And, there was definitely this perception of, this central area of Los Angeles, being a den of vice and that sort of thing. So, I mean, even before the mass suburbanization of the 40s and 50s in the United States, there was really this sort of urge to spread out from the area that had been or urbanized initially. There was a very strong will at the local level and, when the federal funding came in. With all these various levels of government funding towards the car, what you had happen was these massive areas of land outside of the center of town went from being farms straight to being low density tract housing type of developments. You have the San Fernando Valley, which became known as America's suburb. So these massive areas that weren't thought of as urban at all of a sudden became urban. It was a massive upheaval in terms of just the logic of the city. It gives Los Angeles, what it's known for today, which is low density sprawl, the diffusion, I would say, of the areas that are recognized as sort of where people do business, where art and culture happen, the development, the construction of the freeways created this sort of logic to the city where, you know, people's way of life, I guess, is not based on, okay, I'm going to live outside the city and commute in, but, you know, I'm going to have my house in an area that, you know, suits me. You know, it's sort of more of a lifestyle choice rather than a practical, you know, calculation based on translation and housing costs, I would say. So find an area, you know, finding a neighborhood is sort of more like finding a nice suit or a nice pair of clothes or something. It's more to fit your lifestyle than it is to, you know, a practical calculation.
Los Angeles, I understand, is now trying to build a couple of light rail lines and so on. It's trying to sort of retrofit a more traditional rapid transit network onto the city. Is that ever going to be possible in a city this big and this sprawling and this low density? Can you ever sort of flip it from being a car-based city to a rail-based city?
Well, I would say, actually, I am maybe more optimistic than most in this case. There was a very, you know, a brief time, but an important time in the city's history in which, you know, the logic of the development of the city was sort of, you know, based on the logic of the streetcar. And that held true for the areas that were urbanized at the time. But the areas that weren't, you know, were completely sort of centered around the car because that was the new thing. Why are we going to worry about streetcars? So these areas in which you had the streetcars running, they still maintain that sort of more urban character. When I was a kid, we grew up, you know, in an area of Long Beach that was just a little under a mile from what's called downtown Long Beach, such as it is. We had a corner store that was a block from our house. And every day when we wanted groceries, we'd go out and, you know, get them there. And I never thought that was a big deal. But then, you know, I would sort of later come to realize in a city like Los Angeles, you know, most people don't do that. Most people get in their car and drive, you know, a mile, 2 miles to a grocery store. So, but with the future of, you know, a rail-based transportation system, I think is really, you know, based in the past of the rail-based transportation system. I did a piece, you know, a little plug here from a piece I did. This is a little over a year ago now, based on some really great research from, I think, a team at UCLA. They looked at the densities of areas that had been built near streetcar stations, and how that density had increased over time. And even after the streetcar shut down, the density increased. So that, I think, in itself, in those areas where there were streetcar stations, I think can, if they pull it off right, I think can serve to be, to sort of resurrect, you know, another, it's not going to be the same system, but another kind of rail system. Because, you know, in order for rail to work, there needs to be density. But there are places where that is the case. And I think we already sort of have the roots of that in the new system they built. The streetcars closed. The last, red car in Los Angeles ran between Los Angeles and Long Beach in, I want to say, 1963. And then the first line to reopen in Los Angeles was the same line. So they had left this sort of right of way of the train line unused. And so, you know, thankfully that no one built on it. So they were able to sort of resurrect that one line. That line now sort of, I believe in the beginning, you know, sort of had a tepid reaction, but it's been there now 20, 25 years, and it has built a ridership base. It's definitely, I mean, I would say that, you know, it's still very segregated, I would say, from certain areas of, or certain ways of life, I should say, of Los Angeles. I mean, there are people who ride the blue line, which is the line that opened between Long Beach and Los Angeles, every day. There are other people who don't even know it exists in Los Angeles. You know, it's slowly building up. And I think if it has a future, it is in the areas that kind of were created before this mass suburbanization and, you know, the massive sprawl. Because once you have the logic put in place that's around, you know, a streetcar, more mass transit oriented development, you know, that stays in place out of sort of, I guess, economic necessity. You know, in London, Paris, New York, you know, you can get from anywhere to anywhere on mass transit. The problem with Los Angeles is, where are those anywheres? I mean, there are still areas. I mean, central Los Angeles is still a sizable part of the city. The problem is, when you say, where is anywhere in Los Angeles? Where are the areas that matter to people in Los Angeles? I don't know, Beverly Hills, the Hollywood Hills. Where are the areas that really grab people's imagination? You know, those areas are not near the transit lines. I think it reminds me of that sort of the classic song about, you know, nobody walks in L.A. from the 80s, where they say, you know, the actual lyric isn't nobody walks in L.A. It's only a nobody walks in L.A. So, you know, you have these areas of L.A. that, you know, are very walkable. But I think that, you know, that's really what separates Los Angeles from, you know, and that's sort of the nuance that I'm trying to get at, you know, when you talk about Los Angeles as a car city. It's a car city in the sense that the places that matter to people are only accessible by cars. I mean, in New York, where do people want to go? I don't know, you know, Midtown, Broadway, Times Square. In Los Angeles, you know, people want to go see Charlie Sheen's house or something. You know, you're not going to get there on a subway or on a bus.
If you'd like to contribute your thoughts on your city for this feature, you can get in touch with us on Twitter, Facebook, or by email.
So, for our map of the week this week, I think it's about time we talked about probably my greatest achievement in journalism and cartography, and indeed life, I fear. I'm never going to top this, which was the Friday afternoon back in those halcyon days of April 2015, where I just decided to drop a map of Paris on London to compare the size. So we talked about this a bit earlier. Paris proper is actually pretty small compared to London. I mean, if you kind of, it took me ages to line up the two sizes, by the way. I don't want to whine, but there's quite a lot of admin and using multiplication tables here. But yeah, Paris proper, if you kind of drop it on London, it stretches from sort of, what's that, West Kensington down to Bermondsey or Rotherhithe or something. It's actually, it's basically just central London, isn't it? It's like, much, much smaller.
It does make a mockery, really, of these comparisons people make of city size based on the number of people, because they're like, well, Paris has just decided that that's the relevant bit. But I think if you were to make it up from scratch now, that's never where you would draw the boundary.
No.
And they are redrawing the boundary, yeah. So it's the proof is in the pudding.
But yeah, I mean, this is something that is an issue for a lot of cities. So, like, New York is a much bigger official geography than Paris of the five boroughs, but it's still ever so slightly arbitrary, and that, like, you know, the Bronx is in, Westchester County is out, the urban area on Long Island beyond Brooklyn and Queens is out, Staten Island vexingly is in, despite the fact there's quite a lot of water between Staten Island and the rest of New York, and actually if you want to go by road between the two, you have to go via New Jersey. It's just really weird and arbitrary, but they should sort it out, is basically what I'm saying.
Well, geography isn't on their side. I mean, they are a peninsula.
But yeah, but I'm just saying, you could do it better. You've been listening to Skylines, the City Metric podcast. It was presented by John Elledge and Barbara Speed and produced by Royfield Brown. Our theme music is Dust from the Stars by Charlie Charles. You also heard The Weather by Destinazione Altrove and Embryonic Waves, composed by Matthew Reitzel. All music in the show was licensed under Creative Commons. You can find Skylines every 2 weeks on Acast and on iTunes, where you'll also find two more shows by our excellent colleagues, Seriously and the New Statesman podcast. In the meantime, you can find all the stories about cities, maps and geography you could possibly want on our website, citymetric.com. You can also talk to us on Twitter and on Facebook, where there's a pretty good chance we'll talk back. And if you wanted to leave a review to tell your friends how lovely we are, well, we'd very much appreciate that. Thanks for listening.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
지하서울역입니다. 내리실 문은 오른쪽입니다. 명동.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Yeah.